It's time to wake to sleep with the number one sleep authority, Sleep Science Today, and Sleep Better Tonight.
Welcome to another episode of Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and today we're going to be talking about pediatric sleep. So our guest is Allison Edgety. She is a pediatric sleep coach, and she's going to bring us all through the entire infant through elementary aged children and issues that she deals with and help us kind of sort these things out so we know where to go if we're dealing with a particular problem in our own family. So Allison, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, we're happy to have you because these are interesting issues and important ones for people that are struggling with them and don't know what to do or what they should be doing. So let's see if we can't educate them about these things. In order to start off with that, let's learn a little bit about you. So you're a pediatric sleep coach. Tell us, how long have you been doing that? What got you into it? Give us some background.
I like to say this is Allison 3.0 because I was an investment banker for 7 years.
Oh my God.
Then I wanted to move back to my college town, and this was pre-COVID, so you couldn't work remotely everywhere. So I switched careers to do that. I got into fundraising in higher ed, and during that time I had my children, and I'm fairly type A. I'm a problem solver, I'm a planner, and I really went into parenting with too big of an ego, I think, and I thought I had a plan and it would all be great. Parenting is very humbling, and I quickly learned on many fronts, but the most painful one being sleep, that not all children are by the book. Mm-hmm. And so my oldest struggled with sleep for 2 years until I stumbled upon a sleep consultant, and she fixed a problem that the pediatricians couldn't fix in 11 days. And I thought, this is mind-blowing to me. And so when I went back to the pediatrician's office and I said, help me understand how I was in here for 2 years asking multiple doctors for help and they couldn't help me, the pediatrician said, the truth is we aren't trained in sleep. That in medical school, we get 3 hours or less training in sleep. And unless we've sought out additional education, it's kind of like asking the mom at the park. And that, I couldn't shake it. So I was a nerd and I worked at a university and I started to dive into the research, ultimately got certified as a sleep coach, kind of started this little side business 10 years ago. It'll be 10 years in June. It grew and grew. And then ultimately, even though I loved my job at UVA, I left that job and focused on sleep coaching. So it's been 10 years.
Wow. Wow. So just a comment for the audience here, following up on what Allison was talking about here in terms of doctors versus sleep coaches versus other professionals. So yeah, it's amazing to me, although it's not really that amazing because there's so much that I guess doctors have to learn in medical school. You can't cover every single thing. But sleep is something that is not really covered. And in the real practice of sleep, because so much of sleep is behavioral, it's not like there's a, I mean, in some cases there can be a physical problem, but generally it's a behavioral problem. And doctors aren't trained in that. They're trained in the physical stuff. Let's do a blood test. Let's do an x-ray. Let's do these types of things to see if something's going on. So it's a very common thing that people will go to their pediatrician or whatever, and the pediatrician is just, it's not that they're a bad pediatrician, or it's just the wrong place, wrong person, wrong issue. And so that's why we have this whole discipline of behavioral sleep medicine, which has been growing over the years to address that concern. So I just want to kind of fill the audience in so when you're going out to look for help, you're looking for the right help in the right place.
Right.
Okay, so you had an issue to deal with. Well, let me start off. How many children do you have today and what are their ages now?
I have 2 children and I have one is about to be 12 and the other is 13.
Oh, okay. Great. Mm-hmm. So the 13-year-old is the one that you said you were having issues with as a child, correct?
That's right. She's the inspiration for all of it.
Well, can you give us a little bit of background about what types of troubles were you having with her and what did you try before you kind of really got, I mean, I know you said you went to the pediatrician, but tell us more about what was actually going on for you.
Sure. So I had read a book that worked well for friends of mine, and I don't even like to say what the book is because I'm not, by no means am I saying it couldn't work. I think a lot of these books and methods can work for people, but we got going. I was following it to a T. Again, I am fairly type A, and somewhere around the 12-week mark, it started, it wasn't great sleep, but it was kind of on track with the plan, and then it really went south as she was entering kind of that four-month big developmental leap, which really happens closer to 3 months, but it started to go a little bit sideways. And we then at the 4 month doctor's appointment, he recommended a different book. And so I took that book down. I started to implement it. We would have moments where we'd see improvement and then she would quickly slip back. That's discouraging when you're a parent and you wonder, am I doing something wrong? This isn't working. So ultimately, when we hired this sleep coach or consultant, she really helped us work on the timing of her sleep and kind of understanding what works with her personality. So she actually needed a little bit more of a hands-off method. She was kind of misinterpreting some of the things we were doing, which I think is not uncommon with toddlers in particular. So we just had to, I guess my takeaway from it was some kids have what I would describe as like a 25-piece chunky sleep puzzle. You put a couple pieces in place and it's like, oh, here's where the rest of the pieces go. And then other kids, like my first daughter, by the way, my second daughter had the 25-piece chunky puzzle. She was sleeping through the night at 8 weeks. Yeah. My older daughter, though, her piece was like 1,000 pieces. And it had to all be put together perfectly in order for her to fall asleep, stay asleep, and get the sleep she needed. So that was really eye-opening to me that not only are not all kids by the book, and I think this is true in almost every area of parenting, but just some kids have more complicated puzzles than other kids.
So what specifically was happening with your older daughter, I'll say? Was she just not sleeping through the night? Was she not getting to bed? What was
she would go to bed. This is another reason where, you know, so many people, if you just get over the hump of bedtime, like you do a bedtime routine, they put themselves to sleep, the rest kind of comes together. We had that. That worked in the sleep training process. Do a bedtime routine, she'd put herself to sleep. She would be back up sometimes within an hour. Sometimes she might make it till 11 p.m., but then she was very hard to get back in the crib. She didn't want to self-soothe back into the crib. She wanted to be held, and she was very prone to early waking. So by the time we hired the sleep consultant, she wanted to start her day at 4:30 or 5 in the morning. Then because of that, we kept her on two naps way longer than we should have, because she was so tired. And so her whole circadian rhythm was just completely out of whack. And ultimately, I think a huge piece of her puzzle that was counterintuitive and is so counterintuitive to many parents is that she needed to go to bed insanely early. So for as we reset her circadian rhythm, I left work early for like almost two-week period to make sure that we could have her in bed no later than 7. Ultimately, we kind of backed her up almost closer to 6 just to kind of let her body adapt to how much sleep it needed to catch up on sleep. She had a very early sleep cycle. So that was a big piece of it, was really finding the time that allowed her to fall asleep into a high quality sleep out of the gate that carried her through. So she still was an early riser, but we got her sleeping at 5:50. 5:50 was her kind of wake time, which is really early. Very rarely do I work with a child who we can't comfortably get sleeping past 6 a.m. But she really 5:50 on the clock, and it wouldn't matter if she went to bed at 10 p.m. or 6 p.m. That's when she was going to wake up, was 5:50. So figuring out what set her up to get optimal sleep was a big piece of that, and the early bedtime was critical.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So is this what you're describing when you haven't talked about it here, but you and I spoke about it before the show. Is this the wake windows that you're talking about?
Absolutely. So I was not going off wake windows. Again, this was 13 years ago. Wake windows were not a thing. 13 years ago. They weren't a thing when I became a sleep coach. So they're kind of a newer, I don't know, last 5 or 6 years, I think some well-meaning sleep consultant or sleep coach probably came up with them, but they aren't evidence-based. So I was somewhat going on wake windows in that I was just thinking she's been up so long and she looks tired, I'll put her to bed. So I would say in reality, what I thought I was following is more like her sleep cues, her sleep signs.
Mm-hmm.
But similar to wake windows where people will say they've been up, the chart says they've been up X amount of hours, this is when they should go back down. And my daughter is a perfect example of kids that's not going to work well for, because she wanted to wake up at 4:35 in the morning. Then if I was putting her down for this crazy early nap, which basically was giving her a split night, she was almost continuing her night sleep early in the morning. Mm-hmm. So I always tell people with wake windows, if they're working, I think it's great. If you're using wake windows and they work for your child, that's great. I think they're more likely to work for a child who has a little bit simpler puzzle, who's a little more naturally inclined to sleep, and they will kind of lengthen their naps and kind of mature along the times that the charts say. But if you have a more sensitive child who's not as naturally inclined to sleep, the wake windows are consistent, but the timing of their sleep stays inconsistent because sometimes they're waking at 5, sometimes they're waking at 7. Therefore, their first nap starts at a different time every day. Then sometimes, probably based on the timing, their nap is 30 minutes or it might be an hour. And when that happens, their circadian rhythm never really settles. So they're just in constant flux. So I do like to remind parents, if wake windows aren't working, you're not doing anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with your child. Wake windows are not evidence-based at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just not what's going to set your child up for success because they're not naturally inclined to kind of fall into this rhythm. So you want to look for start times really about 18 to 20 weeks. So they don't really have the maturity in their circadian rhythm development prior to that. But after about 18 or 20 weeks of age, you want to find what is the best time for them to take nap one within about a 15-minute start time. So we're really focused on kind of anchor start times. What's the best time for nap one? What's the best time for nap two? What's the best time for nap three? What is their bedtime window? That does vary a little bit more because you can do a rescue window on a bad nap day to make up for some of that missed day sleep. But you want to find those anchor start times because that allows their body to settle into a rhythm. Similar to you or I, you know, they mm-hmm. tell us, we don't always do it, but the sleep experts are saying you should go to bed around the same time. You should start your day around the same time. That's what sets our bodies up for consistency and high quality sleep. It's actually true for the infants and young kids as well.
Mm-hmm. So, all right, I just want to clarify one thing. So we never gave an actual definition of the concept wake window. Is that a certain, I'm not even going to try. I'm going to let you tell me.
That's a good point because I feel like everyone talks about wake windows, but sometimes people don't know what they are. So the concept of a wake window is, let's say your child wakes at 7 a.m. and there are all these charts online that parents will find and they'll say, if your child woke at 7 a.m., their first wake window of the day, so between morning wake up and second nap, should be, let's say, 2 hours.
Okay.
And so from whatever time they woke up, whether it's 6 a.m. or 7 a.m., you're hitting the clock for a 2 hour wake window. They're going to be awake for 2 hours, then you're putting them down for a nap. So if they woke up at 6 a.m., you're putting them back down at 8. If they woke up at 7, you're putting them back down at 9. And then typically, since I don't follow them, I don't know what all the wake windows are, but then it's like there's a certain amount of time they should be awake between nap 1 and nap 2, nap 2 and nap 3, and then before bedtime. And then it changes as they mature. These wake windows typically get longer as they mature. And so it's about how long you're keeping your child awake between each sleep period.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So I have a follow-up question about that. I'll tell you what the question is, but then we're going to take a break and we'll come back to answer it. So if it sounds like the way that you're describing wake windows, it's a very rigid amount of time between waking and then the next nap. I'm going to come back for clarification on that, but first we have to take a break. We'll be back on Sleep Science Today with Allison Edgety, and I'll see you on the other side of the break.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
All right. We are back on Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We are talking about pediatric sleep. So we were talking about wake windows before the break here. And I wanted some clarification. When you are describing wake windows, are you saying that the concept of a wake window is whatever time my child wakes up, I'm going to give them this strict block of time before I give them a nap? Or am I hearing that wrong?
That's right. It's a strict amount of time that they are awake, whether they had good sleep, bad sleep, they're awake this specific amount of time before they go down for their next nap or for bedtime.
Okay. And with your older daughter that we've been talking about, that was not something that you would have worked for her because she was on sort of her own little sleep journey.
Yes. Yes. A roller coaster.
Okay. So, all right. So as you are learning this, because you said you went to the pediatrician, they gave you these books, you had another book, you're starting to learn about these things. So how did you actually finally kind of figure out what your daughter needed, what worked best for her?
Well, the reality is, and this would take us down a whole nother realm of mental health struggles that come from lack of sleep. I, at that point, had a second daughter who, luckily, I did do things differently with her sleep because I was like diving into the libraries at the university to be like, what should I do here? So I didn't follow a book. I did things differently with her. And she was sleeping. So that was good. But my older daughter still wasn't sleeping. And I had terrible postpartum anxiety. And so I was a little bit on my own spiral of just feeling like I was failing on the home front. I was working full time. So feeling like I was not my best self there. Ultimately, what really prompted me to look for a solution was at a Christmas dinner. My daughter was back up. My husband went to try to soothe her. And my parents kind of said, we're worried about you. You are not yourself. We're not sure what's going on. And where that conversation shook out, because I said, we're also worried about me. I know I'm not myself, is they said, you need to figure out what your next step is. You need to be resourceful, remind yourself who you are, find a solution. And so what came to mind is, I'm just so tired. And I didn't know I had postpartum anxiety. Sometimes when you're in it, it's hard to see what's happening. But all I kept thinking is when I thought, what do I need help with? I'm so tired. And the universe, God, whatever you want to believe, I went back to the office that next Monday. And lo and behold, on Facebook, a little post popped up of a sorority sister of mine posting on a sleep consultant's page. And I thought, I don't even know what that is. I have no idea. No one had ever mentioned a sleep consultant to me. but it was like, let me just give you all my money. I really don't care. If you have any solution, I'm going to do it. So I didn't even do an intro call. I was like, some people I know follow this person, I'm in. And so that it was like luck. Maybe it was me opening my eyes to realizing I needed help. And sometimes when you decide you need something, you see it. So that's kind of how I stumbled upon it and decided that was the step that I needed to take for her. And then I just put my trust in this woman, and luckily she knew what she was doing and it worked out.
Fantastic. So obviously now you have to tell us what is it that she did that was different that you were not doing that you found to be useful?
I mean, the big thing, and she really had to work with me on this one, was putting her to bed earlier. Because in addition to that being counterintuitive, like, why would I put her to bed early when she's trying to start her day? And I wasn't doing anything crazy. I think I was putting her to bed at 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And then but she wanted to start her day so early. So if I put her to bed earlier, is she going to want to start her day at 3:30 or 4? And then in addition to that, there was the mom guilt piece of that, because I wasn't getting home with them from daycare until 6 p.m. So when she's saying, I need her in bed by 7 so we can help her kind of catch up on sleep, I thought, well, that's crazy. I'm never going to see her.
Right.
And ultimately, I, again, kind of just had to surrender. I thought, what's 2 weeks? I'm going to give, if this woman can fix this in 2 weeks, I can reevaluate what I'm doing with the bedtime. And so it was that. And then actually being a little more hands-off with her. She is a highly sensitive person. She still is. She's very in tuned to energy. I always joke when she was like 3 or 4 years old, she could be sitting behind me in the car and I could think to myself, oh shoot, I left that something on the kitchen table, and while I'm driving, wouldn't say anything, and she'd say, Mommy, what's wrong? Because like I had a thought process.
Right.
And so what this woman encouraged me to do is, I'm sure she probably registered that I was struggling with anxiety. She probably could see what I couldn't, but she's like, I need you to do less, because I think you're doing more and you're putting a lot of energy that's not helping her, which also, again, counterintuitive. And she said, she's got your skill sets. You've taught her to put herself to sleep. You know she can do it. Take a step back. And it wasn't just me. My husband was also doing things as well. But so with her, and this is kind of another rabbit hole we can go down, a more hands-off approach was better. Mm-hmm. We stopped picking her up. We went in less often. We were thoughtful about any time we intervened that she was already really agitated. So we weren't taking her from like a mid-level to a high level of agitation. And so she's an example where we got far less crying when we did less. And I always say, when people ask me, like, what's the best sleep training method? What method are you pro or are you against? I'm not pro or against any sleep training method. I think what you try to figure out is what method is best aligned for your child. Sometimes a lot of picking up is very stimulating. It's like parents, I'm actually very stimulated by physical contact. Like sometimes I'll feel touched out when my kids were little and they're touching you kind of all day. By the end, it's like, oh, it almost feels like it hurts. Right. And sometimes it's that way even with our infants. We're trying to soothe them. We're like, come on, go to sleep. And it's not working because it's overstimulating. So I think that was another piece of it, is realizing we were almost over helping her. Mm-hmm. And she needed less. But in conjunction with that, she needed to go to bed earlier so she could fall into a higher quality sleep out of the gate and get past that 1 to 2 hour wake up. Because once you have fragmentation, it's going to continue.
Yeah.
So it was kind of getting that initial stretch to improve and then doing a little less, frankly.
So explain this part then. You're talking about, okay, so we realized that we were going to put her to bed earlier. Mm-hmm. How did that go when you first did it? I mean, did it work right away? Really?
Right away. Because what I tell people, and this could lead us into like toddlers, I work with tons of people who come to me with like a 2 or 3 year old, and they say they're not falling asleep till 9:30 or 10. And I say, okay. And we do all the planning. But a big piece of that is we're going to do lights out at 7. And it's like, okay, well, do you want us to inch there? Should we go in like 20-minute increments? No, because if we're out of alignment with their rhythm, we're out of alignment with their rhythm. So inching there and moving it to 9 o'clock, you're still out of alignment. So that's not going to be very helpful. Mm-hmm. And so we did a rip the Band-Aid off, which is scary, admittedly, because I had to do it myself, kind of rip the Band-Aid off to this early bedtime. But if you have paired that with not letting them take some crazy late nap that means they don't have sleep pressure, it works like right out of the gate. I help people do it every single week, and everyone's always shocked that their child fell asleep so quickly. It's because we have not let them move into second wind mode. It's a little bit like if I stay up past 10 o'clock, it's like, watch out, world. I could take on a big project and keep working on it. But if I went to bed at 9:30, 9:45, I'm going to go right to sleep. So I don't inch them forward. And we didn't inch my daughter forward. We really cranked her forward initially because she wasn't napping well. So she went to bed even earlier than 7 initially because of poor naps.
Okay. So you said you really were working at 5:30 to get her to bed now, right? That was.
Well, I would kind of try to be home by 5:30 to make sure we could get her to bed early. But yeah, she had plenty of nights where she was in bed by 6 o'clock because she wasn't napping at daycare. And so she had lots of early bedtimes.
Okay. So when you started that, you said it worked well. She fell asleep. What time did she wake up? Did she wake up earlier? Did she wake up at the time she normally was waking?
She started to consistently wake kind of after 5:30, which was a big leap forward from 4:30 was kind of where we got stuck right before we started. Mm-hmm. So, and one thing that we were keeping an eye on, which I think is important for all parents of all ages, is how much sleep is your child actually getting? Because it was a little bit of proof of concept of how much sleep she could get. So if she was going to bed closer to 6 and sleeping until 5:30, I'm like, okay, well, boom, we got 11 and a half hours of sleep. She can sleep 11 and a half hours. And that was another kind of conflicting piece of the pediatrician at times would be like, okay, well, as long as she's getting, you know, close to 10 hours of sleep, I would argue I don't think that's enough for an infant to thrive, to be kind of their best self. And so one thing that we were really encouraged when we were working with a sleep consultant, and I encourage all parents to do, is, well, how much sleep could you get? Sometimes we got to back into that. How much sleep could they actually get? And once you have that, you know they're capable of it. And then we ultimately were able to shift her to a little bit later bedtime. But for years, she loved that early bedtime, for years and years.
Right. Wow. Okay. So that leads us into another topic that I want to make sure we have a chance to talk about here, which is as we move into the toddler ages and we talk about bedtime resistance. So before we get into that topic, it's a perfect time to take our second break. So I'm going to do that now. When we come back, we will talk about bedtime resistance with Allison Edgety. Be right back.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK House Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
All right. We're back on Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and we are going to be talking about bedtime resistance issues. Can you tell us, first off, it kind of says what it is, but tell us, what is the definition of that and what types of things do you deal with your clients?
Yeah, I think when you think about toddlers, it starts to become the stall tactics. You know, one more book, one more hug. I don't want to go to bed. Sometimes they're verbalizing that, or just their actions are clearly indicating that. And so it's that, when you mentioned at the start of the show, kind of there's this behavioral piece that's sometimes not related to anything medical, and you really can start to see that with toddlers, where it's a true behavioral piece, and it's age appropriate, because what they start to learn, I really start to see it a lot of times around 16 months and up, is developmentally they're learning, I can do X and make someone do Y. And then as they test that out, sometimes something that seems so harmless, because maybe you have time and you are ahead of schedule, is like, can I have one more book? Sure, we can read one more book. And it's like, huh, fascinating. What else can I do? And it's a little bit like pulling the thread. Mm-hmm. And they get going, and parents get stuck in the, okay, well, if I just do this one thing, then they won't have a tantrum. And then they'll get to bed sooner. They, with all good intentions, think they're moving things along to bedtime. But it's a real slippery slope with some kids. And this is where, again, demeanor is such a big piece of the puzzle, because my kids are polar opposites. I could have read an extra book to my one child and it would not have led to anything on additional nights. Whereas my other child, it's like if given an inch, she's going to run a mile. And so it's very specific to the kids, but it's just bedtime resistance often is just stall tactics.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So if you say, no, we're not going to have that next story, we're going to actually go to bed, you don't get a meltdown or a breakdown? Or if you do, how do you handle it? Like, what's the best way to deal with that?
Yeah. So I think it's actually a little pre-planning, because doing it on the fly is going to get the biggest reaction. So if you've kind of been going along with all their extra requests and more hugs and more water and whatever it may be, and then suddenly one night you're like, no, we're not doing that. It's like, what's not how we do things? And then you get this huge explosion of feelings. And so a big piece of that is think ahead. Don't do it on the fly because you're tired and frustrated and you're kind of over it. Decide what you are going to do. So I always tell people, think about your sleep rules or your sleep steps, which are really your bedtime routine, and write them out. Even though your toddler probably can't read, you're just going to have them up there. So this is a step. It could be we take a bath or wash hands. We brush our teeth and put on our pajamas. We read 3 books. We get tucked in and sing a song. And then we stay in our bed and sleep until the light turns green. So have them out and then talk to your child before bedtime. Hey, starting tonight, we are going to follow John's sleep rules. And, you know, tell John what his sleep rules are and say, so if you're asking for things that they would typically, whatever their stall tactic is, starting tonight, we're not going to do that. We're just going to do these things. Now, just to be clear, that does not mean you won't get a tantrum, but it does mean when you say, oh no, step 4 is to read 3 books, not 4. We've already read 3. We're going to move on to step 5, which is to get tucked in and sing a song. Even if they throw a tantrum, which I always say we got to buckle up for their big feelings, and they're allowed to have them, also age appropriate for them to have those big feelings, inside they're like, huh, They did tell me that's what's going to happen. Oh, they're doing it. I would say it's like you can be on the same team with your child, but you have to be the team captain. But if you've prepped them, that tantrum is usually different, but still can be big. But it's also much more of a learning moment than like a sudden battle that felt like it came out of left field. Mm-hmm. So it's more of a learning moment tantrum than a like we're just duking it out because I want something and you want something and who's going to win. This is, no, I'm the team captain. I told you the plan and I'm just helping us stick to the plan. So right. That can be just game changing to communicate what you'll no longer be doing, but also what you will be doing.
Mm-hmm. So when you're working with parents and you're dealing with this particular issue and one or both of the parents say to you, oh, but I don't want to do that. That's so harsh. They're not going to like me. What's your response?
Mm-hmm. And some kids are good. I just had in a sleep log last night, a child said, do you not love me anymore? That's what the parent typed. I'm like, oh, right. Dagger to the heart. So I like to remind parents, and I have to remind myself of this often in my own parenting journey, is children thrive with structure and routine. And what really can help children feel safe is knowing they can count on you and trust you to do what you say you're going to do. There's a lot of security in that. And so whenever, and this is actually true for me, sleep hasn't been an issue in our house for, you know, well over a decade, but whenever I have a pain point with my children, I kind of come back to, we're having the same pain point, the same battle over and over. What structure can I put in place where I can lead, communicate it and lead it in a way that gives my children security? It does not mean they're going to say, oh, thank you so much for that lovely plan. But it does mean as I'm holding them to it, there's security. So I would argue, even though kids will sometimes throw that dagger of like, maybe you don't love me, I would respond to that with, I love you so much. And sleep is so important to your health that even if you don't want to do it, even if it's not fun, I'm going to help you do it because that's how much I love you. And so I think it's reminding yourself that children thrive with structure and routine, and that also sleep, which I think we've made a lot of progress in the last 10 years on the knowledge of this, is mm-hmm. so critical for their health and development. Mm-hmm. And so you can remind yourself, like, you're giving them a gift that many of us as kids didn't get, because when I was growing up, it was kind of like, you'll sleep when you die. It just wasn't like a big priority. And I think that's why a bunch of us are walking around with autoimmune diseases and all this other stuff. Because it wasn't a big priority. And so I think parents can give themselves a little grace and relieve themselves of some of the guilt when you remind yourself how critical this is for your child's health and well-being.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's important. You have that short-term pain, but long-term gain. And that's the thing you're striving for. So I love the way that you phrased it to help the parents phrase it in a way that the child understands that this is a good thing, not a punishment.
Absolutely. I always tell people to try not to threaten their children with sleep along the punishment lines. Like sometimes they'll say, if you don't stay in bed, I'm going to leave the room. That's kind of a threat versus mm-hmm. here's how you could flip just that little example. It seems like me being in the room is kind of distracting. If me being here is distracting to you, then I'm going to take a break and then I'll come back and we can try again. There's also some energy shifts you can do where we're almost doing the same thing that you were doing, but we're shifting the language and we're shifting the energy because the threatening and kind of acting like it's a punishment around sleep does not help kids like sleep anymore. Versus we can almost do the same action, but say we're doing it to help them. Like, I'm going to help you by leaving because I'm distracting. Mm-hmm. But then we can come back, we can try again. And sometimes it helps kids kind of reset. So there are also these kind of little language shifts you can make that shift the whole energy of the experience for kids.
Excellent. I think that's a really good point. So there's one other thing I want to make sure we hit on, and we have a couple minutes here. Kids continue to grow. They get into elementary school. And then comes the question, how do I know if my kid's getting enough sleep? I don't have the owner's manual. How do I know?
Right. I think elementary school is an interesting one because you have this feeling that your child's getting older, and obviously they are. And you think, well, they're getting older. They need a later bedtime. And now you have kids pushing for a later bedtime. And they'll say, my friend Susie goes to bed at 10 o'clock, and kids are talking about it. And so there's this social pressure. And so what I like to remind parents is children's circadian rhythms don't actually make a very significant shift until they go into early puberty. And so that's somewhere from usually like 8 to 11 years old. And so and my kids are great examples of this too. They've even entered puberty at different ages. So even though they're only 18 months apart, their journey of when their sleep shifted was well over a year different in age between the two. So what you're looking for is how much sleep is allowing your child to thrive. So I always say get curious about how much they can get, because also I have one high sleep needs child and one who's kind of on the lower sleep end. So my high sleep needs child, who's about to turn 12, she still goes to bed. Her ideal bedtime is 7:30, and she will sleep till 7. Now, we don't always hit that. She plays travel sports, but we come back to that to kind of get her reset. So anytime we're home, it's like, okay, let's refill your tank here. Mm-hmm. And the reason I think parents should really care about this in elementary school specifically is being sleep deprived leads to struggles in three areas. So it leads to struggles in emotional regulation, impulse control, and learning retention. So if your child is struggling in any of these areas, and this is where parents are suddenly like, okay, let's get tested for ADHD. And I have a child with ADHD. I'm not saying it's not that, but you can get more accurate testing for all these things that you're looking into if your child is getting enough sleep. So come back to how early could I get them to bed? A lot of elementary school kids still need to go to bed between 7:30, maybe even 8. But it's earlier than you think. It's earlier than many doctors are telling you to put them into the thrive category. They'll get by on less sleep. Many of us did. But are they thriving? And so that becomes important. Elementary school becomes really important as you move into middle school and kids are getting grades. We probably don't have time for me to tell this story, but I unintentionally did an experiment on my own daughter and her grades dropped. And the only change I made was getting her more sleep, and her grades popped right back up. Hmm. So the impact on academics can be huge. And I want to scream it from the mountaintops because I don't think people are talking about it.
Right. Right. Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's when all of our memories consolidate and all the learning happens, is when we're sleeping and our brain has a chance to process everything that we've been doing during the day and all the inputs that we've been getting from school and all that. So, it's incredible how I think back to myself in college. You know, you would stay up and do an all-nighter and cram all this stuff, and you would have been better off going to bed.
There's a great talk by Matt Walker that he gave to Google, and you can find it on YouTube. It's really, really old. But they did an experiment with college kids where they would keep them X amount of hours sleep deprived and then try to have them take these tests. And it was really interesting. And to your point, I had sent for years, I was sending this video to every child I knew who was about to go to college, because if I could rewind time, my college experience would have been so much easier and less frustrating to me if I had just gone to bed. That 24-hour library did not do me any favors, because I would study till some ungodly hour, sleep for 3 hours, then try to go take this 8 a.m. exam. I really just need to go to bed. It didn't matter what I studied. It didn't get stored there. And then I'd be panicked that I'd show up at 8 a.m. to take this test and think, oh my gosh, I know I was just studying this. Sleep is, this is why I tell my kids all the time, I will cut them off from studying. I'm like, just go to sleep. Just go to sleep. It will be there. And I also think it's important for parents to know sleep before you learn is important. So to go into a classroom well-rested, your brain is primed to take in what that teacher is teaching. So it's important on both ends. Sleep prior to learning. And then, as you pointed out, when you sleep after, it's when you store it away. So we have to kind of prime the brain to learn so it can actually hear what the teacher's saying and then store it.
Right. Well, we are actually out of time. So as much as there's so many more things I'm sure we could continue talking about, we've reached our limit for today. So let's do this. If people wanted to get in touch with you, is there a way that they could do that?
Absolutely. My website is sleepandwellnesscoach.com. And I also have a podcast called How Long Till Bedtime.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Fantastic. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to share all this knowledge with us on our show here. And for the listeners, we have a new episode that comes out every week on Sleep Science Today. And you can visit our website, www.sleepsciencetoday.com. So we look forward to seeing you all next week. And Allison, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have been listening to Sleep Science Today, your number one sleep authority.
Sleep Science Today.